Hey guys, it's me, Camille.
And me, Tim.
Happy New Year to everyone.
Yeah, we hope 2017 is off to a great start.
Perhaps some of you out there made resolutions about food or getting in better shape. We didn't.
Which is why we're starting today's show at a bakery.
Yum.
Yeah, it's early on a recent Saturday morning, and Danielle Humphrey is standing in front of a counter full of flour and icing and measuring cups.
Could use a little more cinnamon, but work with what we got, make it happen.
The 29-year-old is putting the finishing touches on hundreds of small cupcakes. There's all sorts of unusual flavors, too, like green tea, cookie dough, pancakes, and bacon.
Have you ever heard of a cupcake, pancakes, and bacon?
No.
Anyway, but at the moment, she's adding sprinkles to one called birthday cake.
Is Saturday around the holidays just, like, crazy busy for you guys in the shop?
Well, this morning is, just because we have so many orders, but we just keep pushing.
Tucked inside a cozy red brick shop in South St. Louis, this is Contrary Cupcakes. Danielle opened up the bakery about a year ago, and business is good.
Yeah, the previous Saturday she sold about 250 little cupcakes.
Hustling to keep up.
Oh, yeah.
Danielle is part of the fastest growing group of entrepreneurs in the country, Black women.
According to a report commissioned by American Express Open, the number of businesses owned by African-American women grew more than 300% since 1997. They now own more than 1.5 million businesses in the country.
I knew I wasn't going to be part of the machine for all my life. I've just never been that type of person.
And when it came time for Danielle to get the money together to open this little storefront, she didn't go to a bank or an outside investor. She did what many entrepreneurs do. She worked her network.
In Danielle's case, that meant going to her mom.
I had to prove to my mom that I was serious about it. I won't say the amount that I borrowed from my mom, but my mom was my investor, so I didn't have to go to a bank because there's no interest rate with mom. So that was definitely smarter. There's an interest rate with the bank.
And like we told you earlier, so far the investment is paying off. Danielle and her mom are even talking about opening a second store in the future.
But as a group, Black women face big hurdles when it comes to getting the kind of financial backing it takes to get their businesses off the ground. That's the big takeaway from a new report from the National Women's Business Council and the Small Business Administration.
What's more, this can be especially true in high-tech fields like medical devices, biotechnology, software, that kind of stuff. The numbers are stark. According to a study by Digital Undivided, an organization founded by a Black woman investor, only a third of Black women startup founders raised outside funding.
Not only that, the average amount was just $36,000.
That's pocket change compared to the average $1.3 million in outside funding raised by typical startups, which are more often than not led by white men, which leaves a lot of Black women stuck between business opportunity and access to capital.
So, on today's show, we're giving you a two-part episode. In part one, we explore what life is like inside this gap and why it exists in the first place.
And in part two, we tell you about what some people are doing to try to close it.
We live here.
We live here.
We live here.
We live here.
A project exploring
race,
class,
power,
poverty,
systems and the people they touch.
I'm Tim Lloyd.
And I'm Camille Stanley. And from St. Louis Public Radio, this is We Live Here.
When we were researching and reporting out this show, we made a list of successful Black businesswomen, and it was a long, long list.
Which shouldn't be surprising, since Black people have owned businesses since, you know, forever.
Mm-hmm.
And like we said at the top of the show, Black women in this country have been one of the fastest growing groups of entrepreneurs.
But many of them find themselves facing a few key challenges. Not a lot of access to loans, small social networks, and not a lot of support.
This fits exactly with what we heard from Rachel Hankerson.
We met up with her at a hip co-working space for tech startups in downtown St. Louis.
I am the founder and CEO of International Proof Systems, where our mission is to improve antiquated processes through advanced technology.
Okay, that's a mouthful. Here's what it means in non-businessy speak. Rachel created technology that would go into a new type of license plate with the driver's registration and insurance information embedded into it.
That means no more tag stickers and no more trips to the DMV, which sounds good. I'm sure
there's
a few of you out there. All right, so Rachel says these electronic plates would both cut back on fraud and save states money by making the licensing process more efficient It's an idea she first had as a college student back in the 1990s.
She wrote it down in a notebook, and that's where it stayed until the Great Recession, when Rachel lost her IT job at a local university.
I had a gig every now and then, a year, 2 years, a few months, but I needed something a little more steady, a little more secure. So I said, rather than continue on having my hand out for an employment opportunity, I said, I'm educated, I do have experience. Let me do what our grandparents of the 1930s did. They rebuilt America out of the Great Depression of 1930. And I said, I'm capable of doing the same thing. Let me just roll up my sleeves, use my expertise, use my skills, use my knowledge, and bring back my little invention that I had at the age of 21. And that's what I've been doing since 2010.
And at the time, it certainly seemed as if St. Louis was a great place to start our company.
Right. I mean, the city is constantly finding itself on top 10 lists for places to launch a startup.
Yeah. So Rachel dumped her savings into building prototypes, started looking for investors, and tried her hand at business competitions.
But finding investors has been tough.
I've been through, speaking with angels and VCs. I've been through the ARCH grants, economic development grants, competitions, and denied by them all.
Rachel has had some breakthroughs. She says officials in Missouri were open to the idea of the electronic plate, but didn't want to be the first state to give it a try. So she took the product to California.
West Coast officials liked what they heard, even drafting a new law that would allow for a pilot of technology like hers. But Rachel would need to supply a road-ready prototype first, and to do that, she needed money.
For a 12-month prototype with 1,000 units, we've been asking for $3 million. Considering we have not gotten $3 million, went down to $1.5 million just to get us over. We were not successful with that. This is over the course of 6 years. We went down to $50,000. Right before we went to California, we said, help us with $10,000.
And without the money to start a pilot program, interest from California faded. Meanwhile, word has gotten out about her idea.
And other companies have debuted similar products, though Rachel has a patent pending on her technology.
What is more frustrating is that someone else could try to take it from me with more manpower, more resources, someone that doesn't look like me.
So after years of this, Rachel has come to an unsettling conclusion.
The economic wealth here sits in one pocket. Investors invest in people and not necessarily companies. I think when they see me, they do not see me as a very potential a business owner with great potential success, where no one negates the success, the need for my product and service. No one's negating that this is the next wave of the future. There has to be something. Like I shared with you yesterday, yes, people have told me if I was a different race and if I was a different gender, this would be further along than what it is. So I know that it's not my business model that they're rejecting, it's me. It's been quite a journey, but I believe in my business, I believe in my product, and I believe that one day it will be very successful. I just have to keep going.
And she's headed back to the West Coast next month, hoping investors this time around will be more open to her pitch.
To get a sense for the type of world Rachel is stepping into, we called a bunch of tech investors around the country. And before we get to them, you should know that investors can be broken up into two big groups. The first big group are called angel investors. They're people who get in early and use their own money to get startups off the ground.
The second big group is venture capitalists, who manage other people's money and look for more mature companies that will grow into mega businesses.
Okay, let's start with the angels.
You have to be pretty rich to be in this club, with liquid assets of at least $1 million. And angels usually give a lot of startups a little money, and most of them fail.
But if one of these deals pays off, these investors stand to see a big return.
We can only look at companies that a 10x return is a possibility on our money.
This is Christopher Mirable. He's the chair of the Angel Capital Association. He's also co-managing director of Launchpad, a network of angel investors that specifically puts money behind Boston-based startups.
He's pretty straight up about the fact that not a lot of Black women are getting early-stage capital from his investing group.
It's not a great story in terms of the statistics. I went back and looked, and in terms of the last few years, female CEOs, are clearly a minority, and female CEOs of color are a minority within that minority.
According to Christopher, the members of his angel network don't care about race. They care about making money on a great idea.
At the same time, he doesn't see many pitches from black women, and no one seems to be complaining about that.
You know, and I could see a member asking about gender, but I've never had a prospective member ask about race. And perhaps, you know, part of the reason for that is that anybody we interview, you know, to bring in as a prospective member has already come to at least one meeting as a guest, and they can see for themselves, you know, how many faces of color are in the room and make their own determination.
The conversation about who's in these meetings and why they tend to all look the same remains limited at best. When LinkedIn surveyed 600 of its users in the tech startup world, it found that 70% of startup founders say their company has no program to increase diversity. That same survey found that most women say they've witnessed sexism while trying to raise capital for their startup.
And almost half of non-white respondents say they've witnessed racism in the venture capital world. So how does all this play out when investors are getting ready to place a bet on the next big thing? Ashton Newhall is a good guy to answer that question.
Personally, my family's been in the venture business for three generations. My grandfather used to work with Lawrence Rockefeller, what is now known as Venrock. My father left an asset management firm called T. Rowe Price to start a firm called NEA with two other founders, which is now one of the larger venture funds in the world. I was always raised to think that the venture capital was the land of the free and the home of the brave. It was really where money meant opportunity.
Ashton's Maryland-based venture capital firm, Greenspring, manages around $5 billion.
And if you recall, for the most part, venture capital firms like Ashton's usually back companies that have already raised at least some money. But these startups are still far from being safe investments.
I think it's human nature when you're dealing with risk assets to want to associate yourself with people that you trust in a given field. And it's just as a function of history, if you will, that, you know, certain groups have been underrepresented in certain facets of, say, the technology business, as an example. And as a function of that, it's a very it's a much more closed culture than one would assume.
And based on all the research, along with all the people we talked to, that culture is especially closed to women of color.
So whether it's a deep-pocketed individual angel investor or a high-profile venture capital firm, this is a huge part of why startups founded by black women don't get much funding.
It's a problem that Ashton first started thinking about 7 years ago.
And as I started to come into leadership in my own firm, I looked to my left and to my right, and I guess I realized that, you know, that the types of entrepreneurs that I was seeing were not emblematic of what the demographics of this society in which I live.
But the venture capital world can be hard to change at the very top because firms are usually composed of such a small number of partners. So Ashton started filling the highly competitive lower-level analyst positions at his firm with more diverse candidates.
You know, we're not looking to hire to a quota or to a certain standard, but we thought that by injecting people into that process, that would ultimately naturally result, based on merit, in hires. And that has come to be, both at the senior and the junior level. But I would admit that we're still early innings in this whole process.
But a lot of black women we talk to say they can't and aren't waiting on this process to just play out. We called one of these entrepreneurs up on Skype. Hi, Morgan. It's Camille in St. Louis again. We're talking to Morgan DeBon, a St. Louis native. A lot of you listening may recognize her name. Morgan is the founder of Blavity, one of the biggest websites for black millennials.
And just a few years ago, Morgan was a student at Washington University here in St. Louis.
She, like many of the black women we talk to, say entrepreneurship came naturally.
I was the girl who, when they were banning candy in the vending machines, I went to Sam's and bought a bunch of candy and started selling it at school directly to my friends. And so, you know, throughout kind of my childhood, I've always tried to figure out different ways to change a dollar into $1.50 and figure out how to charge people for random things, including my own family.
Morgan came of age right as St. Louis was sprouting its tech roots, and she even worked at a tech startup in University City where she first realized there was a way to mix innovation, entrepreneurship, and community.
So she asked a mentor for some advice about what to do after graduation. He suggested she move to Singapore because of its fast-growing economy. Morgan chose San Francisco instead.
It's the difference between having a meeting with someone and being like, you know, I think I might want to, you know, raise $10 million and build a $300 million business. Like, what do you think about this idea? In St. Louis, you might not, people might look at you a little funny, right? Like, they may be like, you know, I don't know, right? Like, I don't think it would be received the same way. In San Francisco, people are like, why aren't you building a billion-dollar business? Like, why are you thinking so small? Think bigger.
Just thinking bigger wasn't enough. Remember, this is San Francisco, where you can sit in a coffee shop and hear people talk about starting $100 million businesses.
I really wanted to make sure that I had investors who understood the mission and understood why creating a new media platform and a new community was something that was important, particularly for Black people and Black people in this country and in this world. And that's not necessarily easy to find in the Bay Area.
So Morgan found other ways to get the money she needed to get her idea off the ground. She put in her own savings, started small, and built a company while working a full-time job in business development.
So I didn't take the traditional Silicon Valley route of raising venture funding, which would be to, you know, take 500 meetings, make sure you're on Sand Hill Road, going door to door to all the VCs. I didn't take that approach because I knew going in that those investors most likely would not get it, and I might waste more time trying to raise money instead of raising and building my business.
Morgan also got creative about generating revenue. Blavity got into the conference business, and you know what the first one was about? Black women talking to each other about starting businesses and being leaders in their communities.
That conference was incredibly profitable. And so that was like a really good way for us to make money early on without having to rely on venture funding.
And Blavity recently hosted another conference for people of color in tech. Morgan says it was a reminder that as this community of entrepreneurs grows, so does their network and their influence.
I also see some people who are my peers who are rising in the ranks and will soon be managing partners of big traditional funds, and I think that's really encouraging. You know, I'd like to think that with more visibility, it would mean more people in the pipeline, more people thinking that they too can create a media company in 3 years. They too can, you know, take a web series and get it in a premium network like Issa Rae has done, or they too can be, you know, Bose from Apple. You know, I hope that that's true. I think that institutions that have been built by, you know, white heterosexual men since the beginning of this country are very going to take a long time to break down.
There are people, including some right here in St. Louis, who are trying to break down the tech investing world and rebuild it to become more inclusive. We'll tell you about that coming up in part two.
So in the first half of the show, you heard all about longstanding issues many Black women entrepreneurs face, pretty much the what and the why. This next half of our episode, it's all about the how.
As in, how does the problem get solved?
What would it take to close this gap between opportunity and access, to widen the pipeline, to build a more inclusive ecosystem, if you will, for Black women entrepreneurs? For answers, we called up Kate Mitchell, one of the few women venture capitalists running her own firm, the Silicon Valley-based Scale Venture Partners.
She says there can't be any progress if there's not first a benchmark, and it helps if that benchmark comes from the top.
Because once you set the example at the start, I think it begins to set a trend that's hard for others to ignore.
Kate and Ashton Newhall, the venture capital guy we heard from earlier in the show, co-chair the diversity committee for the National Venture Capitalist Association.
The trade group recently launched a massive study of diversity across the industry, and not surprisingly, it found very little racial diversity in the venture capital workplace. no blacks were at the investment partner level.
And women overall made up just 11% of those at the very top of the industry.
We obviously are not proud of the statistics, which is why we're moving forward to give people tools to change.
The Venture Capital Association plans to roll out a slew of strategies to its members in the coming months, but it's already recommended these four things. One, that investors recognize that diversity and inclusion is a journey.
Two, that they make it the center of their business.
Three, that they regularly measure how they're doing.
And four, that they hold themselves and their peers accountable.
Now, the trade association can't force any investor to take these steps, so Kate says it helps to make the business case for diversity.
We can't be successful and ignore a huge amount of the population, both as entrepreneurs and as customers of the companies that we are investing in. So there is an economic reason to do this. I mean, I always say it's not just good, it's smart.
And a lot of this work, Kate says, comes down to simply expanding networks and giving business owners advice about pitching.
As I say to folks, I hope that my going out coaching entrepreneurs on how to approach venture capitalists helps those entrepreneurs. It is also helping me. How is it helping me? I not only am improving my network, I'm improving my comfort level. I'm also getting used to seeing somebody who isn't in my close network across the table. And that's what the average white male VC needs to do too. So that's going to be two worlds coming together, and both sides have to do work to get comfortable with each other, that the black female entrepreneur knows who to contact, how to contact them, how to establish a network, how to use LinkedIn, how to use research around who's investing in the area that she is doing work in, just as that venture firm has to be open and thoughtful about doing outreach beyond its existing network of natural deal flow. So it's a big problem. I mean, I'm not going to tell you this is going to be easy, but if we don't start, we're not going to get there. But I think that's the thing. That chasm between that woman and that conference table where she gets to pitch and then where she gets to pitch to actually get funded, that's a long road right now. And almost any direction is up.
Now, of course, this topic isn't just on the minds of investors at the national level. Back here in St. Louis, people are trying to figure it out, too. Gil Bickel is a financial advisor for Wells Fargo.
He's also the past chairman of the St. Louis Archangels. It's an investor group formed a little more than a decade ago.
Since that time, we have actually financed about 75 different companies to the tune of about roughly $60 million in the St. Louis area.
Gil says he can't recall any of the companies being led by black women. And 3 years ago, he wanted to start a specific equity fund for entrepreneurs of color.
But he says there were a lot of roadblocks, not from fellow investors, Gil says, but from people who wanted capital.
If you're a professional investor, putting up money for someone else to utilize in a business, you're looking for confidence in the entrepreneur. So, and a lot of other issues too, planning, accounting, financial controls, a belief in the plan, that it's not a one-trick pony, that it has the ability to actually grow, because our thinking was we didn't want to just start a business with one person. We wanted to start a business that would grow, you know, to multiple employees, you know, et cetera. So I guess what I'm saying to you is that to some extent, it was such a cultural divide that what we thought we were looking for was not what it was that the entrepreneurs that we talked with were willing to provide.
Gil says he tried for 6 months to find partners in St. Louis's black community. He says he went to churches, spoke with business people, and with entrepreneurs. He wasn't impressed.
According to him, the people he encountered weren't thinking big enough or didn't have the education or the right business plan.
You know, we really went back to the drawing board and said, okay, how do we make this happen? And the answer was that we weren't the people to make it happen. You know, in other words, this is ethnic, but, a guy who is in the finance business, doesn't live in the community. I'm not African American. And I think people were scared of us. You know, they were scared of me because I think they felt like they were not prepared to deal with someone who was just totally foreign to them.
Gil says he also realized that solving the issue would require more resources and time than he had.
We devoted an amazing amount of hours to the process and just came to the opinion that, number one, you needed not only a money fund, you needed the mentoring. But the other thing that is lacking, I think, is the motivation from the community itself.
And so he abandoned the effort. He never made a deal to start that fund.
It's unclear if the St. Louis Archangels has any current diversity and inclusion programs underway. A spokesperson for the group declined our request for an interview. This, however, isn't the only story in St. Louis, which is why we're at a converted warehouse that's supposed to serve as a launch pad for biotech startups in St. Louis.
Cheryl Watkins Moore is showing off a wall full of company logos that are supposed to represent local success stories.
So BacteriaScan is one of the companies that they've invested in. Edison AgroSciences. Catalyst, and what you'll see here is a mix of different types of companies, from medical device companies to agro.
Are any of these companies we looked at headed by Black women?
None. None. And most of them are not headed by women at all. I think
And it's why we wanted to connect with Cheryl. She heads up the diversity program for BioSTL. It's an organization trying to combine St. Louis's tech, medical, and plant science sectors into one big economic engine.
And the reason I took this opportunity is because what I saw is that most of the time, minorities and women, we don't get involved in markets until they are on the decline, or that they plateaued or on the decline. What I saw differently was this is an opportunity where this market was exploding and it was growing and there was opportunity, there was funding, there was all the things that you look at in a new market that was being availed here, and we needed to be aware of it.
Cheryl was tapped for this job because she knows a thing or two about overcoming challenges as a Black woman entrepreneur. The Chicago native is a medical doctor by trade who joined a Swedish company that figured out how to regrow gum tissue in your mouth from a protein that goes dormant after birth. It's crazy.
We just got to stop because yeah. That's pretty far out.
Yeah. And so it was during this time while she was working for this really cool little company that she first caught the startup bug.
We grew it to $60 million business, and within 7 years we were acquired by a much, much larger organization out of Switzerland. So we did our job.
And a couple years ago, Cheryl formed her own company. It combines physical therapy with video gaming.
I mean, if you look at women anyway, I think we have been, especially Black women, we have faced many challenges. When you talk about just being here in this country and feeding our families and growing our wealth here, we find a way to do it. And I think that when you talk about ingenuity, oh my God, we will find a way to do it. But it's still unfortunate that we have to do it that way.
She's hoping that will change soon, but not with another program, boot camp, or conference.
Cheryl and others in the region have decided that in order to really build a more inclusive startup scene in St. Louis, they have to rewire the whole thing.
They want to gather regional data about women and minority businesses, build tracking systems, and provide anti-bias training for local entrepreneurship support organizations. And their plan just got a big endorsement and a nice-sized check.
Yeah, the Ewing Marion Kauffman Foundation is putting $420,000 behind the idea. It's a slice of a much larger $4 million grant for similar projects nationwide to diversify entrepreneurship.
Alex Krause is a researcher at Kauffman who studies what it takes to help women and entrepreneurs of color start successful businesses. And she says St. Louis's systematic approach makes it stand out.
And something that these organizations should be thinking about if they want to be inclusive, if they want women, if they want people of color, if they want Black women starting businesses, is what does the culture of the organization look like? Are these support organizations staffed and led and have board leadership by women and people of color, by women of color? That is really important. It sends a really big signal to potential entrepreneurs. It helps create that network, so it's not looking like just a white male-dominated industry.
In St. Louis, a wide cross-section of the region's startup community says it's ready to change that. And step one is getting everybody around the same table.
Welcome to the first official meeting of the funded St. Louis Equity Entrepreneurship Collective. Thank you, Kauffman Foundation.
This is Natalie Clay. She also works for BioSTL with Cheryl on this new initiative, which has been nicknamed The Collective. And as everybody goes around the table for introductions, you get a sense for just how many different groups and organizations are represented.
Jennifer Eelin, Prosper Women Entrepreneurs.
Delicia Saw, Arch Grants.
Christine Karslake, St. Louis Economic Development Partnership.
All right, everybody is literally around the table. People are feeling good about things. So now what?
I think it probably is worth us stepping back and just reminding ourselves, like, what is it that Natalie put in all those emails about what we said we were going to do? And, like, can we actually do that? And, like, what?
And they certainly have a lot of work to do.
Officials can't even say right now how many women or minorities there are in St. Louis's high-growth startup scene. That's why they need to do the data.
Next, they want to come up with the best practices to measure what's working and what's not, and figure out what it will take to scale up the success stories.
The ultimate goal, organizers say, is to not just limit the collective's work to the tech world, but to improve equity for entrepreneurs regardless of industry here in St. Louis. And as Natalie reminds everyone, they have a tight deadline.
And as I really mapped out what we said we were going to do over 2 years, I said to myself, well, who decided we were going to do all of that? It's a lot to do in 2 years. So with all that being said, I am going to kick our friends from We Live Here out, if that's
aww.
Okay.
Oh,
yeah, I know.
That's right, guys. We got kicked out of the meeting.
But it's cool. We're reporters.
I can take it.
It's not the first time that's happened.
No. And for the record, it wasn't a public space, so we couldn't just stick around anyway. But like any good journalist, before we left, we made them promise to let us come back.
They agreed, which means we're going to take you guys with us when we do come back as we continue to keep you posted on this effort and whether or not this gap we've been talking about today actually does start to close a little bit. But before we end the show, we want to let you know we're not the only ones watching what's happening here closely.
Yeah, we ran St. Louis's plan by a guy named Bobby Franklin. He heads the National Venture Capitalist Association, which, if you recall, just launched its own push to diversify the investment industry. They did the survey.
What a great story it would be if St. Louis ended up being the magnet for wonderful entrepreneurs from underrepresented backgrounds that then started showing that, you know, okay, you're now attracting the best deal flow of people with this background to come to have success there. And, you know, what if you became that place that, you know, for women, African American, whatever the demographic may be, found a great support entrepreneurial ecosystem in a region to have great success? And then how many people would be jealous of you? I mean, that's, you know, that's where we hope to get.
And Bobby says this is a problem that St. Louis has the potential to solve before Silicon Valley.
Because it's small enough that if leadership in the region wants to, it can help everyone find a seat at the table.
We Live Here is produced by me, Camille Stanley.
And me, Tim Lloyd.
Cassie Morgan composed our theme music.
Sheila Newman is the executive editor of St. Louis Public Radio.
And from St. Louis Public Radio, this is We Live Here.
Support for this podcast comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.